everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I am here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you today?
I'm just fine. I had a wonderful afternoon, and I'm ready to tell some interesting tales.
That sounds great. And before we started here, I let you know that, again, not trying to be a numbers watcher, but we have one more subscriber since the last episode. And we do appreciate all of our subscribers. Yes. We really do. And if you are watching this on YouTube or Rumble or whatever video platform or your audio platform, consider clicking the like, hit the subscribe, hit the bell on YouTube. You get notified when we release new content. We have a bunch of Facebook groups, and the links for everything will be down below. And the same thing for the email address, paranormalist@theparanormalistpodcast.com, where you can send us your ideas, your feedback, whatever you'd like to send us. And we'll be happy to hear from you. And with that, I think I'm going to turn things over to you. And what will be our topic for this evening?
So tonight is Planes, Trains, and we're doing some interesting mysteries. So we're going to focus on trains and planes and ships.
Oh, so when you started out there, I'm thinking like John Candy.
No, I've actually seen that. That's not a bad little movie. It's funny.
That's
but, it's not bad. I'm not a big American comedy fan, but I did enjoy that one.
Well, John Candy was Canadian anyway.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. So you taught me something tonight. All right.
I consider it a great day. I mean, even at my advanced age, I consider it a great day if I learn something new every day.
I have to tell you, it's rarely the day goes by that I don't learn something interesting. So let's get on to our mysteries. So I was doing some research on a different topic, and I came across this first story, and it's sort of what put me going down that rabbit hole. So about 125 years ago in New Brunswick, Canada, this would have been on June the 21st of 1900, so, you know, approximately, like I said, there was a train called Locomotive 508, and it was a combination of freight cars and passenger cars. And it was headed from Edmundston to Fredericton. And along that journey, there's this place called the St. John River, where a wooden trestle, you know, allowed the train to cross over the river and continue on its journey. Now, there's no great mystery in the fact that wooden trestles sometimes would stress and fail. They're wood, and over time, things would rot, wiggle loose, stuff like that. So that's pretty much what happened, is the trestle failed to stand up to the weight, and the train plunged into the river. Mm. But it managed, when it plunged in, all the passenger cars were above the water line. So even though people were injured because of the tumbling and what have you, nobody died, which is a miracle. And I'm sure everybody there was happy about it. There was 104 people in that car, in those cars. That was a lot of folks, you know. They were hanging kind of off the edge of the trestle and down with the other cars in the engine in the water. The mystery of this story is they managed to get all the cars out of the water, but the locomotive has never been found. The locomotive would have weighed about 35 tons. It was a steam locomotive. Very heavy iron, and to this day, nobody has ever found it. They have no clue where it went, and I just find that fascinating. I lived for years as a young person where there was a wooden trestle and trains crossed it. It's not a unknown thing to me, and yes, you could see where boards were beginning to rot, and they would come every so often, and they would pry them up and put new ones in and what have you. And I can't imagine, the water wasn't running. It takes a lot of force to push 35 tons, you know, downstream. I'm not going to tell you it's impossible. During the 1889 flood of Johnstown, there were trains that were pushed, entire trains pushed down, but they were also forced by that huge massive wall of water going down the hill. So gravity was playing a part, and then the weight of all the debris as it's picking up debris along the way. This was not like that. Oh, and nothing has ever been found of it to this day.
That's probably not on the planet anymore.
It is hard to tell. And as we go into these stories, we're going to hear some really, really odd ones, and maybe that is one of the possible solutions for some of those stories. So my next one is about a train that was going from St. Louis to Saskatchewan. I couldn't say that. And it's known historically as the St. Louis Ghost Train. So basically, there's a section of track where a train often appears in the distance, and you can hear it, you can see it, and along with the train is a red bullet of light. And that's exactly how they describe it, a red bullet of light. Not on the train, but running along the side of it high up in the air. And it appears out of nowhere. People see it. It gradually moves toward them. And it just disappears as they get close to the railway crossing, where mostly the people notice it, because people notice it most of the time sitting in their cars at the railway crossing where there's a stop sign or a stoplight, and they're waiting for their turn, and you're looking both ways, mm-hmm. and you see in the distance this train from another era shooting towards you, and this bright light shooting along the side of it. And as you're sitting there staring in wonder, it gets close to you, you hit the gas, you want to get across those tracks but away from that train, you shoot to the other side, look back, and there's nothing there. There's no story. This is the fascinating part to me. It's coming up the track from the St. Louis end as headed towards Saskatchewan. And there's no story, no great tragedy, nothing. And after they pulled the tracks out, so I don't know what people know about other areas, but a lot of the United States, what they've done with old train tracks is they pulled the tracks themselves up and turned them into like trails or biking trails or walking trails or other scenic recreational areas. So the trails, the railroad has pulled up all those rails, but it's still, you can see a train shooting along.
And you, from where you grew up, you're probably familiar with the Lower Trail.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Just one of many right here.
Yeah, there's a ton of those kinds of trails. But I can't imagine you're walking along a trail and you look down, you know, down the road, and there you see this bizarre train shooting up the walking trail or the biking trail at you.
Yeah, and so obviously, I mean, when the people look back, you know, if they went across the tracks and they look back, then there's no train there. So, all right. So phantom train, let's call it that.
Right.
But is that an echo of a previous train, or is that, just something out of time that, you know, we have, you know, we've talked about time slips before, you know, and right. Is that, you know, possibly a time slip? And if you happen to be too close to that train, would you be sucked along in that time slip with it and end up where it came from in the first place?
Well, there is a story coming up where we may be discussing that in much more detail.
Oh, okay.
So,
disclaimer, yeah. I had no idea.
You didn't. No, and it's a great thing. Like, usually these stories are accompanied with, there was a train crash there on September 20th of, you know, 1897, and all the passengers aboard, you know, were injured or dead, and like you have a story to go with it. There is none. There, I mean, obviously it was a train track, obviously it was used well, but there are no known disasters, tragedies that occurred at that spot to give rise to the story. Which I've read 1,000 train stories because trains are fascinating to me. You and I both are from central Pennsylvania. And the one town in our region was railroad capital of the world. The whole region was just, you know, polluted with trains and the lore and the magic of trains. And yeah, trains are magical. I could tell you so many things about them that are magical, and my memories of them are magical growing up. And you know, I still grin like a little kid when I climb on board a train. I'm 10 years old, and this is my great adventure. So, yeah. But there's nothing. There's not a single thing. So now we're going to move on to a train taker. And there's going to be a couple folks who passed along the story. But this one's kind of interesting. So there's a gentleman by the name of Jack Hayden. He was a ticket taker in London's Covent Garden Tube Station. So that's their subway station. The year is 1955. He locks up his area after he's finished working that night. And he encounters a gentleman who's very elegantly dressed. He's got top hat, gloves, cane, the whole nine yards. And he's sort of surprised because, you know, before you lock up and gate your area, you look around to make sure nobody's inside. So as he's getting ready to leave, he sees this gentleman. He apologizes profusely and unlocks the gate to let the gentleman go by. And the guy just disappears. So Hayden's rattled, you know, as anybody would be late at night as you're going to see this gentleman. You're like, oh, I'm so sorry, sir. I didn't know you were still here, you know, and the whole nine yards. So about four nights later, Hayden sees the same man on the staircase right outside his area where he was a ticket taker. And Hayden yells out to him, hey, sir, excuse me, sir. He wants to talk to him. He wants to know what happened the other night. And the man looks at him and just disappears. And Hayden keeps this to himself until he hears that two other employees who work in the same general area on the hours he's not there have had the same encounters with a gentleman they describe very similarly. So eventually Hayden describes this to one of the gentleman who works for the railroad down there for the station. And the guy was an artist, so he started drawing what they each described, and it was pretty much the same man. So the man was somebody recognized. His name was William Tress, and he was an English actor, a stage actor, and he had been a person who had rode, you know, the subway there for quite a while in the late 19th century. Over the next few decades, people seeing this man would report seeing him over and over again. Now, here's what makes this interesting. Although Tess's ghost is also supposed to haunt the Adelphi Theater, and other places, he does apparently haunt the subway station. And here's his story. On December the 16th of 1897, Tess was playing in a production at a local theater nearby when he was stabbed to death by an actor named Richard Archer Prince. He had fired this gentleman from another production, and the man was getting revenge. So he was known to be kind of an alcoholic, mentally unstable. They'd gotten into heated debates and what have you. Prince took off running down through the subway area after he stabbed this gentleman, Mr. Tress. And he was eventually caught, went on trial, was found to be insane, ended up in an insane asylum, and would spend the rest of his life there. There were people in the theater world, including Tress's family, who believed that this guy got off easy, being in a mental facility rather than in a prison. And there is a speculation that Tress is either still trying to make that journey home, or he's still appearing in both the theater and there because he's trying to say that he's not happy with the outcome of what occurred. And so he just disappears in the tube station as soon as somebody gets their attention.
Well, I've been in London, and I've been on the, you know, on the tubes before. At least when I was there in the mid to late 80s, they shut down fairly early. Like I thought it was before midnight. I mean, yeah. So if you didn't catch a train, or you didn't catch the last train to get to where you're going to, either you, and it was hard to find a taxi too, because you had to call and reserve a taxi ahead of time. So you're walking, and London's a big place.
Wow. Yeah. I cannot imagine. So for those who listen from other areas, in the area where I live, everything is very, very rural. So you have to have a car, you have to travel to go anywhere. My job for many years was an hour and a half away from my home. There was just simply were no jobs in the area where I live. And getting groceries could be a 45-minute drive. You know, going to a Walmart or something like that could be a half hour, 45-minute drive. it was, everything takes forever from here. So the idea of not driving sounds so foreign to me, but I know a lot of people that live in cities who never drive a car because they never have that need. They use the public transportation.
They don't even have a car. Yeah.
Yeah. I just can't imagine.
They couldn't pay, they couldn't afford parking for the car. Yeah.
Fortunately, in the rural areas, it's free. We can just park where we want to.
Usually, but, yeah.
Usually, yeah. I mean, it's even in town, pretty much, you know, unless there's parking in somebody's driveway, you can park any place in town. The church parking lots and stuff don't even care, especially in bad weather. As long as you park at the far end so that they can still plow for their congregation, they're fine. But that's the joys of rural life. So this is the story that I said we might be visiting your theories again.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this is a train from Rome to Milan. And it was a really interesting story. It was probably one of my absolute favorite ones. So in the early 1900s, there was this train and it was built, remind me so much of the Titanic in some ways. It was built as like the finest, you know, cars for travel, very high class, high end kind of situation. And everybody wanted to, although the very well-to-do people wanted to ride on this train. So its very first inaugural run would be on July the 14th of 1911. And it was going to leave from the station in Rome. The train was built by the Zanetti Railway Company, and it put a huge amount of money into advertising this as a high-class tourist train, with all the biggest luxurious, you know, things you could possibly imagine, dining cars, these great big wraparound windows for you to do touring, all this stuff. So they decided for the shakedown run, this first run, they would take 100 passengers plus the crew. Most of these people were very high end, well-to-do people. People from the railway company itself, the owners and their families and friends, that kind of stuff. And they got on the train and took off. And this is going down this route, there is a tunnel that they would have to pass through, which was extremely long. It was actually known at the time as the longest tunnel in Europe. So it was a very, very long tunnel. So they're going down this tunnel, and there was so much hype. People were gathering along the railroad tracks along the way to wave and see this amazing train. And, you know, it traveled at high speed, and it had all this hype around it. Like, they spent a ton of money to let the world know this train was passing by. And so people are standing on both sides of the tunnels, as well as along the railroad tracks elsewhere. And they're waving at the train and yelling, and the train shoots into the tunnel. And the people on the other end, you know, should eventually see it come out. And nobody comes out the other end. Nobody. So people start to wonder what's going on. And eventually somebody's like, well, I wonder if it broke down inside the tunnel. So they decide a couple guys are going to walk in, and they walk in and they're like, there's nothing in there. Nothing at all. Walk to the rest of the way out to the other side. And they're like, did the train come by? And they're like, yeah, it was just clipping along. And they're like, it didn't come out the other end. And they're like, no, come on. It had to come out the other end. Train can't just disappear in the middle of a tunnel. And they're like, no, seriously, I think maybe we should call the police. There's something wrong. So they call the police. And they come out. They look around. Again, they're like everybody else. They are really shocked. And then the police find, laying along the edge of the tracks back in the shadows against the wall of the tunnel, two different people who were passengers on the train. They're badly injured and in a state of shock. They aren't making any sense at all. They end up taking them to the hospital. And at the hospital, a few days after they get to the hospital, they tell the police this bizarre story. I'm going to read you exactly what they gave as evidence. Not very long. So according to these two survivors, the one said, I heard a strange hum shortly before the entrance to the tunnel, in which we saw a white fog that had risen and seemed to wind around the train and literally swallowed it up inside. It was a horrible experience, despite being able to save myself and another passenger by jumping from one of the few railway carriages just before the locomotive entered the tunnel. I was filled with terror and knew that we had to get out of there. We crashed hard to the ground, and that's the last I remember of what had happened. So he managed to pull this other person off with him, and they described pretty much the same thing, a huge whirling mass of white fog that swallowed the train, or the train dove into, depending on your perspective. So after this happened, there was a fear that another train would disappear, so they literally shut down that tunnel and that section of the railroad and rerouted everything else, you know, in other directions, because they couldn't come up with any rational explanation for how this even happened. So, you know, how do you know it's not going to happen again? It was left like that until World War II, whenever bombers actually bombed the tunnel and collapsed it. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. So about a decade after all of this happens, one of the relatives of one of the missing passengers was reading some books, and he stumbles across this medieval chronicle called the Modena Monastery. It's about this monastery. And in this monastery, they find an entry that it tells about a satanic metal chariot from which black smoke had come, followed by three smaller ones. Now, there was an engine and three cars on that train for that day when it disappeared. From these chariots came three servants of the devil who were beardless and dressed in strange black clothes. The servants of the devil began knocking on the door of the monastery, asking to enter, but with the strong bolts and through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary, invoked by the prayers of the monks, they were prevented the sacrilege of entering the church. This man read this and started to wonder, is it possible somehow that this train traveled through time and ended up in that area? That is the same area where later the tunnel would be, where the train disappeared. Now, if that wasn't interestingly enough, a Ukrainian newspaper in 1992, August of 1992, wrote an article about the 1911 Zanetti train incident, and it was called The Ghost Train of the Roads to Ukraine. And this is what they talk about seeing. A ghost of three carriages appeared at the intersection of the duty officer of this gentleman. The train, with the curtains tightly closed and the doors open, and the empty cockpit moved absolutely silently, crushing the chickens that were walking along the street near it. From time to time, a train has appeared for a few moments at the crossing at the village of Poltava in the Ukraine. The article cites the chairman of the Commission for Anomalous Study in the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences as having studied these apparitions for some time. This is also on the same journey route it would have taken to get from where it was to where it needed to go. So it's still on that train path, so to speak. And then another document was found, and this one's way off, but it's really fascinating. So listen to this story. A psychiatrist in Mexico City named Jose Saxion, I believe is how it is, who wrote that in 1840s, there were 104 Italians interned in a psychiatric facility in the Mexican capital who behaved in a surly and confused manner. It seems that they asserted that they were neither Mexican nor Spaniards, but were Italian, and claimed to have arrived in Mexico City in a train that left from Rome. There are those who say that after time, the 104 mad people adapted to their new reality and integrated themselves into a new life. Some went crazy and spent a lifetime in a mental health facility. There are those who say that there is no trace of them ever found again, and no one knows what happened to them after the doctor had let them leave the facility for mental health. So he wrote a journal about all of their stories because they were so very consistent. And there, you can go on and on. 1991, September 25. It was seen in Crimea, and it was written about by a Russian writer. His eyewitness account is interesting. He said, "I rubbed my eyes. I thought it looked like trains couldn't go on rails. Instead, a steam locomotive and three passenger caravans. Both the locomotive and the entire train are not ours. They seem pre-war, perhaps even previous. Traveling without lights from the side of Mount Gasfort along the trajectory of the former railway. I even ran to the spot. No trace, no crushed tufts of grass. A ghost? A damn thing. So I thought, it is not good. It could create problems." And then again, there's more testimony from 1955 of a train going through the area of Moscow. Again, an engine and three cars, and it continued on. So what is going on? Now, there's one last little piece of the puzzle. The gentleman who found the stuff about the monastery at Medina, and he actually owned a estate in that area. And the reason he was looking is because he was one of the two survivors. And he never quit trying to make sense of what happened to his compatriots. So he began reading obscure texts and studying every bit of history he could find. And it was through that process that he began to turn up these bizarre stories.
Okay, so again, you know, well, you kind of know how my mind works. All right, so the people that got off the train in Mexico, right, so they would have had to shut down the engine, stop, and, you know, so did the train stay there? What happened to the train? But every place, all the other places it's been seen, it just continues to move, okay? So there's no way that they would have had enough coal to generate the steam, or even the water to generate the steam, all that amount of time. So to me, that indicates some type of multiple overlap.
Yeah. Now, from what I understand from the Mexico story, they never saw the train. They merely found around the railroad track this group of very confused people. And whoever found them called the authorities. And the authorities thought they were insane. And so they called the hospital and took them to the hospital to have them checked out. But they never saw the train there.
Okay, no, I was thinking of the monastery, though. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Where they got out and actually tried to gain entry. They would have had to stop to get off unless they jumped while it was still moving, you know. So based on that, I wouldn't be surprised if that locomotive and the three passenger cars are still stuck in a time loop somewhere with overlaps, you know, and just continuing that. And it just makes me wonder then, if they're in a time loop, do those people ever, are they still there? You know.
Or did they get off the train somehow successfully?
Yeah.
And get stuck in Mexico City, you know? And
yeah, that's extraordinarily fascinating.
I saved my last train story, my best train story for last there, yeah. And I just, when I read this, I was like, I'm like, oh man, that's cool. And then you read a little further and you're like, oh my gosh, that's cool. Yeah. And then you're going, oh my gosh, that's even more cool. And I'm going down through it. And it's been seen all the way up into the 2000s. This is the Flying Dutchman of trains.
I guess. Which, you know, the white clouds or the fog, you know, again, my mind went to the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
Where people saw, you know, in fact, I was a pretty young kid when I read the Charles Berlitz book on the Bermuda Triangle, and I was completely fascinated. I was hooked by that. You know, I mean, at that time, I liked anything science fiction, or science fact, you know, for that matter. But yeah, that's where my mind went when you said the fog, or when the two people that got off, you know, mentioned the white swirling fog.
Yeah, and I've read many stories of ships, airplanes, you know, what have you, driving into or talking about being sucked in by a strange fog, a magnetic fog, a fog that messed up their instrument panels, you know, that sort of thing. But to pick up a train or an airplane or a ship is just insane. And yet there are those stories.
And the only people that know for certain are the people that are on those conveyances. And
that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. So I'm going to touch lightly on a couple on the other two departments. And if people are interested and want to hear more, there are a lot of other stories. So we are going to touch on ships now. And just for the record, the Bermuda Triangle is the most well-known, but there are different types of triangles and other areas that people cannot sail or fly over without there being a lot of mysterious disappearances. The first one I'm going to talk about is a ship from 1813. It was called the Patriot. And the reason this ship is so well remembered is because of one of the passengers. So there was a young woman on the ship. Her name was Theodosia Burr Alston. She was the daughter of our vice president at the time, Aaron Burr. And Aaron Burr had fled the country before he could be charged and tried for treason. He also shot
The infamous duel. Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. an infamous duel. Although I have to tell you, I'm not a Hamilton fan, so I really don't hold that against him because he probably saved this country a lot of pain in the butt. But anyway, and people think that's the reason he fled the country, but it is not. He was exonerated because, although people don't know this, Hamilton fought multiple duels. He fought several duels. He died by a shooting in a duel. His son had died previous to him by a shooting in a duel. Like, he was just slapping people with a glove left and right and challenging them to duels. Like, there are several ahead of this one. And it was not against the law at the time, and Burr reacted that way. So it was for something completely different, which we can get into on another day if folks are interested. But Aaron Burr was a widower who had lost his wife when his daughter Theodosia was born. And despite the fact that young women were seen and not heard, Burr undertook to raise her himself rather than have nannies raise her. And he educated her himself, and she had a fine mind. She could have been an attorney or whatever. She ends up marrying really well to a man who becomes the governor of South Carolina, Joseph Alston. Now, because of everything that had happened with her father, he fled the country and could not come back to the United States. So he ended up living in France, and Theodosia went through a great tragedy. She lost her only child, a little boy, to a fever, and she was grieving horrendously. She missed her father terribly. So she and her husband came up with this great plan that they would rent a berth on a ship, and it turned out to be the ship the Patriot. She would go out into international waters where her father would come and meet her on another ship. She would offboard from this ship and stay with her father for a few weeks. And when the ship came back through, it would pause and pick her back up to allow her time with her father without him coming into the area where he could be arrested. So that was the plan. She gets on board the ship. It docks. It ends up going, out, just everything's going fine until Alston is informed that the ship never made its first docking. In fact, there is no clue whatever happened to this ship. It completely sailed off into oblivion. There are a couple stories that it was attacked by pirates, and she was recognized only as a very wealthy woman that they might be able to ransom, and that they kept her on this island for a couple weeks. But because she suspected the pirate captain was, and this is kind of gets very romantic, was going to ravish her, and I mean romantic in the classic sense, not in like it's really romantic, that she chose one night to walk into the ocean rather than be besmirched by this man. Though there's no evidence of any of this, none whatsoever. All we know is that the ship took off, it was in good shape, it never got to the first place it was to dock, it never met Burr's ship. Burr would eventually have them reach out to Alston and say, has there been a change of plans? there was no ship that came by. And it was only at that point that they realized the ship had just disappeared into the ocean, never to be seen again. No wreckage, no debris, no other sightings of it at all. Once it left the dock where she boarded, there is nothing. And it's an interesting story. And again, one of the reasons it's so interesting is because of who was on board the ship. But I find it a fascinating story. Usually there's something that comes up, you know, eventually somebody finds something, some debris floating along, or a captain notices something, or what have you. There's never been anything. So we're now going to move forward. There's a ship with the inauspicious name of the Witchcraft.
Okay.
And on December the 22nd of 1967, this gentleman who owned it, his name was Dan Burrock, and he was an experienced yachtsman. He was with his father, and they set sail on this luxury yacht called the Witchcraft. It was for a holiday. They were going to tour along the coast of Miami, enjoy all of the Christmas lights, and just kind of hang for a few weeks and spend time together. About a mile out, the two of them began to experience a difficulty, and they notified the Coast Guard that they must have hit something. They weren't excited. They weren't taking on water. They had stopped the ship. They were just going to wait, and they asked for assistance. Simple enough. So the Coast Guard went out. It took them less than 19 minutes to get to the scene. You know, just say rather than sorry, they weren't too far away. Let's go ahead and answer the call. They find no yacht, no debris, no sign. They spend the next 6 days searching. Nothing is ever found of this ship. They put divers in the water, and nothing was ever found. However, the ship, I don't know if people know this, but the Bermuda Triangle encompasses a lot of the southern coast of Florida as part of its terrain. It had sailed into the Bermuda Triangle right before it struck whatever it struck, and so it did disappear from the Bermuda Triangle.
You do pick them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a fascinating story.
It is. Yeah.
Here's an experienced yachtman. He's done this for years. He would have known if there was a problem. And even if he hadn't, there should have been debris, should have been something. They spent 6 days looking. They traveled like 1,200 miles. They put divers in the water. They sonared it. They did everything they could think of, and nothing. Just boop. And a mile into the Bermuda Triangle, it hit something, and bam. She's gone. On calm waters. Mm-hmm. So our next one is called the USS Porpoise. It was a brig used in the 19th century for excavation and surveying. And it took part in a mission in 1838 to confirm that there really was a place called the Antarctic. And it was a ship that later circumnavigated the whole entire globe. This ship has some history to it. I mean, these sailors knew their stuff. In 1854, the ship set sail for Hong Kong. It carried 69 men that were going to survey the South Sea Islands. And somewhere between China and Taiwan, the ship would hit a dense fog, was separated from a partnership that was going along called the Vicentes. The Vicentes witnessed it sail into this fog, this bizarre fog, and it never came out. They lost contact with it completely. For over a year, because this ship had a lot of really important people on it, and it was on an important mission, for over a year, there were searchers looking for this ship. It has never been found. But again, that theme of the strange fog.
And you know, even today, I mean, recently as today, it didn't. If I'm driving and I see a wall of fog, the first thing that runs through my head is that I really don't want to go into there, number one. And number two is like, okay, if I do drive into there, is the car going to come to an abrupt halt and I'm going to find myself in some Precambrian forest, you know, running into a tree, having been transported back millions of years? You know, so that's, yeah, those are the things that run through my head.
I've read and written so many of these stories that there are these odd things. I'm not a big fan of driving in fog at all. I never have been. Obviously, it's dangerous. You have terrible visibility and you don't know what'll come out of it. I remember, is it 901 goes through West Virginia? There's a road that runs to West Virginia, and it's locals call it the Highway of Bones, because during the Civil War, there were so many people who were laid, they were injured during battles, and they would just be laid along the road as the troops were going through, both Union and Confederate. And, you know, they couldn't take them with them as they were moving. It was just, they were too sick and too injured. So they would just lay them along the road and hope somebody would come and find them and render aid. And so there are all these ghost stories about this particular road. I've driven this road many times because, or at least a portion thereof, because I have a friend who used to live there for 20 some years along that road. And there is a piece of road down there where all the locals will tell you a Confederate soldier, if you're getting swallowed up by this bizarre fog and you're driving really slowly, and this Confederate soldier on a gray white horse that you can barely discern comes riding out of the fog directly in front of you. You will slam on your brakes. You're terrified. You think you've hit somebody. And when you stop the car or look through the rearview mirror, whatever it is you choose to do, the person is still on the horse watching you go by. But only whenever this bizarre fog comes out of nowhere, and you'll drive out of it in seconds. So it's a theme.
Yeah, we don't need tornado chasers. We need fog chasers to get some real data.
Yeah.
Of what these things are.
And yeah, it's really fascinating. So I'm going to tell one more ship story, and then I'm going to move on to a few planes and tell some of those tales. So in 1912, there was a ship. It was 146-foot cargo steamship called the Arahu. And it was passed, I don't know why it was passed through several owners, but eventually it ended up with a car shipping company in Australia. In 1952, it sailed from Sydney with a crew of 18, the destination being an isolated island called Lord Howe Island. The ship was in good shape. There was calm waters. 48 hours after the ship left Sydney, there was the first radio contact, a fuzzy crackling call from the ship. It sounded as though the ship said it was experiencing bad weather, although it was completely calm elsewhere. The last anybody had ever heard of the ship was that call. It was very close to Howe, to Lord Howe Island. It had to be, right, because of the speed it was traveling and the direction it was going when it left. If you figure out the speed and everything, you can tell it should have been almost at Lord Howe Island. Never found, no wreckage, no anything. It carried more than enough lifeboats for all of the crew and the passengers, no survivors. There was no other indications of bad weather. No other ships were talked about anything happening. Just that one radio call and telling them that they hit bad weather. And my only question when I read this is, I wonder if they thought they hit fog, seeing as there's so many of those stories. So I just find it very interesting. So I'm going to start, we're going to talk about a few planes, and then we're going to go through this here. So in October 21st of 1978, there was a young gentleman by the name of Frederick Vonatich. He was flying a Cessna 182L, and he was described by friends and family as a UFO enthusiast. He had been captured by the whole idea of it. Going back to the 1950s, that's when the stories began to really take off and pulp press and what have you. But he loves flying. So he's flying along, and all of a sudden he's in the Bass Strait between Tasmania and mainland Australia. He radios the air traffic control at 7 p.m. saying that he's being followed by an aircraft, not a UFO. He called it an aircraft. And he said he wanted to know if there was any known traffic nearby. He describes it as large, illuminated by four bright landing lights. It passed within 300 meters or 1,000 feet of him, above him, and it was moving at a very high speed. He was frankly disturbed by how close it had come to him. And so he was, you know, he was radioing in and letting them know there is something going on. And this is the reason why planes have to file a flight path and all of this, is because the flight plan helps air traffic control to know who should be in an area at a certain time so the planes don't crash. So he continues to talk with the, you know, with the ground, and he's telling them he can see it better now. He says it's a UFO. It's circular. It's got a metal surface and a green light. Air traffic control tells him to identify the craft, and he said, I can't. It's not an aircraft. I can see it now. It's not an aircraft. His last transmission was interrupted by an undefined noise sounding like metallic scraping sounds. At that point, all contact is severed. Neither he nor the plane have ever been seen again. Planes were scrambled to go out and look for him. Ships were sent to the area. No debris was found, no oil slick, no anything. It's just another one of those tales.
Mm-hmm.
So, a couple more, and then I'll let our listeners go. So, March 16, 1962, a Flying Tiger Flight 739 disappears from radar screens over the ocean. It is carrying 93 U.S. and 3 South Vietnamese soldiers from California to Saigon. There's no, it just literally blipped off the screen. They're tracking it. It's going. There's no other traffic near it. Nothing to indicate anything. And it's just gone. There was no wreckage, no debris found. There was an eyewitness account from a nearby civilian tanker stating that an extremely bright flash of light and two red dots plummeted to the ocean at differing speeds, and that was it. The tanker attempted to go to the area to see if there was something they could do, if there was, you know, a ship had gone down or, you know, the plane had gone down. They didn't know what it was. They just described it as two red dots that fell into the ocean. Nothing has ever turned up to this day. They didn't find anything. So I would normally have not picked that story, except for the fact that there was the tanker there, that they were able to get to the scene so quickly, and that they didn't find anything. You could make a great argument that it was sabotage. You could make a great argument that it just blew up in the sky. But if that's true, and that tanker was very close by, there should have been something they could have found, an oil slick, some floating debris. It gave the military a place to look, and the military looked, and nothing was there. That made that interesting to me. So we're going to go to 2016, July 22nd. A twin-engine transport aircraft belonging to the Indian Air Force disappears while flying over the Bay of Bengal. There were 29 people on board, 23 passengers, and 6 crew members. Radar contact was constant until 9:12 a.m., and it just, again, blipped off the screen. Rescue operations were the largest known in Indian history. 16 ships, a submarine, and 6 aircraft were deployed to aid in the search. That happened, as I said, July 22nd. They searched for them until September 15.
Wow.
Nothing was ever found. With that thorough of a search, I cannot understand how nothing was found.
They weren't looking in the right place. Don't look down, look up.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. It's, yeah, I just find it fascinating. And like, literally, I could do 100 stories on the Bermuda Triangle. I could do the Great Lakes Triangle, has that many. The Alaskan Triangle. There's like 13 or 14 different places around the world where there are way above average amounts of ships and airplanes that disappear. And I chose to start with trains because we can make good arguments for ships disappearing, they sink in the ocean. Planes disappearing, they go down and people don't find the remains. It's a huge planet. But, you know, then you go to trains. Trains can't go that far if they go off the track.
Or that fast, you know. That.
Yeah. Well, except for the one that ended up in Mexico for a while, you know. But you know what I'm saying? So it is a consistent issue. We've done in the past episodes about people who've been traveling in cars and started out in the United States and ended up an hour later somewhere in South America, and they can't explain how that happened. Stuff like that. Something is going on. Maybe different somethings are going on, depending on the particular story. But something's going on. And if you ever have a time when you're going to get on a plane, a train, or a ship, or you're driving along and you feel like you probably should pull over, this isn't the night, you're going to stay at the travel rest motel instead, do it. What's the harm? There are so many of these stories. Nice people. Everything's in the right place at the right time. Everything's beautiful. I mean, that train that I talked about that disappeared in the tunnel, it was its maiden voyage. And they had sunk a lot of money into it. So we know it was in good shape. There's no questions about this. And even if it wasn't in good shape, it would have broke down. It wouldn't have just disappeared. And we have people on both ends of the tunnel waiting for it. I thought it was a fascinating topic, a little off what we've been talking about lately. I was ready for a bit of a change, and I figured our listeners might be too. If they like the stories, I hope they will let us know. If they want to hear more, believe me, I have got hundreds. With that, I am done.
Alrighty, I appreciate that. And since I've already said my little YouTube and Rumble and everything else with the clickies and likeies and whatever, you know, I got nothing else.
Awesome. So then I bid the listeners a wonderful evening, afternoon, morning, whenever you're listening to us, and thank you for listening.
I hope you liked it, Alice.